Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community. Plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's March 20th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We are a DevOps accelerator for funded startups that helps teams who are overwhelmed with AWS, and we do this using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we are here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your bandwidth for innovation and nail your value delivery every time. If you're curious, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and you'll get to book a meeting with me directly. So with that said, let's move on to how you can maximize today's session. First off, our format is informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. If you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, just go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live. Don't miss out. Join us live by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. All right, let's jump into some announcements. All right, so one quick thing Venkat shared before the call here. I'm excited about when you have a lot of repos in your organization, you inevitably have decay. So now the default option when you start archiving your repositories in GitHub is not to list them in the repository list. This got so bad for us, we created a whole separate organization and just started moving all of our repos to that organization so we could get the cruft out. If you haven't been following along with GitHub and what they've been doing there, if you go to any organization and you click on repositories here, the new repositories view is has these facets along the left side. It used to be when you had all, it included archived. Now archived is excluded from all. Now, we've already moved all of our repos outside of this organization, so there's nothing here. But yeah, I probably would have waited to do that if they had just done that sooner. Any other comment on that one? There we go. Next announcement. Anchor.dev. I'm surprised this hasn't been solved in a better way yet. The problem is, like, when you're doing local development for front ends and you want to test that your cores headers are working and you want end-to-end TLS on that, not that you need it from a security perspective, but just so that it's consistent with other services, for example, requesting other assets that are on TLS and ensuring that everything end-to-end is TLS. You want the local experience to also be TLS. The way to do that is you create a self-signed cert, and well, then you either accept a bunch of dialogues or you add your private CA there, but then that's a vulnerability because if anything uses that private CA to generate more certs, you're more easily compromised. So here's a service that's come out that tries to make this part easier for developers to create private CAs. Matt, any part about that I butchered?
No, that right. Seems pretty good summary.
All right. Just making sure. Keep me honest here. All right. So there was that. Now, next announcement was Spacelift. You know, this was an interesting one. If you dial back the clock 4 years almost, I think it was in December, we had a very popular Office Hours segment where we talked about tacos, Terraform automation and collaboration software. And all of these platforms had in some shape or manner, policy libraries or ability to have policies. But that's kind of useless for most people. Because most companies don't even know what policies they should even have in place to begin with. And it requires developing a sophisticated opinion on what you need and your requirements. it really helps if you have a library to look at on what those policies should be. So Spacelift has come out with a managed policy library, a lot like, you know, what AWS has for IAM and the different policies they have there for like read-only, observer, administrative access, etc. So here are some policies for the Spacelift platform, and this is just a screenshot showing you some of those examples. Next announcement is an interesting one here. You know, it hasn't been a great 365 days or past year for HashiCorp. They have been trying to find, you know, their angle, I guess, or niche to capitalize on, and they made all their products BSL licensed, forcing some major changes, triggering OpenTofu. Similar things for HashiCorp Vault has now forked as well. There's been rumors that HashiCorp would probably, you know, go or look for suitors that could acquire them. More rumors have surfaced this past week that that might be the case. I haven't seen any mentions of who would be acquiring them. I saw one which would be like, you know, IBM, but that I'm really hoping that's not the case. What I'm really curious, who would, in a perfect world, assuming that for survival, HashiCorp needs to be acquired, who would be the best suitor for this? And who wouldn't just, you know, butcher the product or mothball it or roll it into some huge enterprise offering that none of us would like?
Can I throw a wild card out there? I would, excuse me, be interested in seeing Oracle pick it up. And I know that that might sound kind of funky, but Oracle has used Terraform as their default infrastructure as code interface since they were a cloud, if I recall correctly.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So, I mean, I would imagine they want to see it live on. I don't know how that's changed or, you know, I haven't looked at it since the recent code or licensing changing on the HashiCorp side. But if they pick it up in a way, I mean, they already have history with Java, you know? So if they pick it up in a way that it can be maintained for themselves, you know, they're in their own self-interest, but in a way that benefits the community and they've got the resources to put behind it, I think it would be kind of interesting to see what Oracle could do with it.
Yeah, I would just add that two things. One, you mentioned Java, but what they did with Java completely splintered the Java community, and they only looked out for their own interests, you know, Sun and then Oracle when they acquired all that. So I don't think they've been good shepherds of open source. Also, when they took MySQL under their wing, they screwed up a whole bunch of things with it as well. And I can't imagine the continued effort to work on the providers for competing clouds to them would continue to get the kind of love that it's gotten under their stewardship. I think my two cents though is that there are very few organizations on planet Earth that could acquire HashiCorp. That makes sense, because if you look at how much money they've raised and the presumed multiples that the VCs are going to expect as a return on investment, you're talking about like a, you know, multi-billion-dollar acquisition, right, in this space. And the only companies that could do that are AWS, Microsoft, Google, IBM, Oracle, maybe a couple others, you know, like, so I'm not exactly sure where this is going to go. I think it's not going to go to a good place, like if it gets sold, unfortunately. And I think like it becomes, if a cloud provider buys it, which the odds there would be very high if you look at the potential suitors, and one of them being a cloud provider, who the other entities that use that would probably not be so happy about using that tool anymore,
Yeah.
or putting a lot of effort into it, if it's
Right.
owned by one of their competitors. So it's going to put it in a very precarious situation. So it's not, this news isn't particularly good news to me, but I don't know. I don't particularly also know where else this could go. It seems like it's they kind of screwed up their strategy a while ago, and they've been, by trying to grow so much and raising so much money and doing all the things they did, they kind of put themselves in this corner, and I don't know how they get themselves out of it, honestly,
Yeah, that's really interesting.
and have all the products survive.
I guess I would be secretly hoping it'd be an AWS to acquire them, but for the reasons you mentioned, I could understand for anti-competitive reasons that Google and Microsoft would not be as bullish on it then.
I don't know. It seems none of them seem like great options to me, and I tried to figure out, what other, I mean, obviously there are a couple other organizations, like Apple could certainly acquire them, but like why? Like it doesn't make any sense. There's a few, but just like there aren't that many companies that are in the tech space that are doing multi-billion dollar acquisitions, for something that isn't, extremely core to their business. So that leads me back to only infrastructure providers, basically, being able to do it, and I don't know how that turns out.
Yeah, a consortium somehow. That'd be hard. That would be ambitious.
The, when you figure out how you get Amazon, Microsoft, Oracle, Google to all agree on doing something collaboratively, then you've won the internet, and you can actually make a lot of money doing getting them to agree on things. So good luck with that.
Any other thoughts on this one? All right. Yeah, exactly, Tim. I was thinking the same thing, Cloud Posse. I just got to go check our bank account, see where we're at.
See that thing right down there? Sponsor Cloud Posse for $1 a month on
Exactly. We just need
GitHub.
a few billion people to make that sponsorship happen, but it could happen. Come on. That's your hint. Go right now. Cloud.com, sponsor Cloud Posse. All right. HashiCorp BSL license Terraform releases a new function is sensitive. It's just amazing the velocity like of new things coming into HashiCorp. It feels like this is a small little feature that allows you now within your Terraform code to determine if some value is sensitive or not, and then use it appropriately. For example, you might want to make sure that some variable you're using was explicitly marked as sensitive by the caller. What would be an example of this? Would it be where you have a you could have a child module that basically, I was thinking the chaining between modules that you could at some point. Cause a value to go from sensitive to non-sensitive, and you want to make sure that you're only passing sensitive values, for like a database password. Is that a use case? I guess I'm struggling a little bit to understand the use case because outputs, you can filter those to be sensitive or not sensitive. Inputs can be sensitive or not sensitive. So I'm struggling to see the exact use case why you want this function. Tamsky, you mentioned SSH key generation. But I don't understand because any output of that, you should be marking that as sensitive in any variable. So it would be in some reflection kind of context where you're in the Terraform code and you want to know that this variable that you are working with is sensitive or not. But all right, someone.
Yeah, it's not obvious. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would mean that there's logic in your Terraform code that depends on your variable being sensitive or not, which is kind of weird. Maybe a test framework in Terraform that so you're using Terraform code to test Terraform code. That could be useful, I guess, as a kind of policy checking, more or less.
Possibly double checks. All right. Next announcement would be, yes, we have Jeremy Grodberg on our team went through and did a pass on our best practices, which we hadn't updated for a long time. There's another PR on top of this one, which hasn't merged, that also expands on some of these best practices here. Probably an interesting conversation to have. Keep in mind that best practices are not universal. They depend on your context and requirements. These are therefore Cloud Posse best practices. And I can't claim that they are, universally accepted by the industry. Let's see, do we have Jeremy on the line today? Be interesting if he would call out anyone in particular here. Yep. All right. Too much to talk about without going into any specifics on that. So we'll probably dive into those later on. Weaveworks has, as you all know, gone under. They have released all of their IP as open source. As part of that is the formerly known as Terraform Controller for Flux. That's now been rebranded as the Tofu Controller. There's been a lot of attempts to implement these kinds of controllers. The Tofu controller, I mean, formerly Terraform controller, seemed like the farthest along of a lot of them. The feedback I consistently hear is just that running Terraform inside of a controller is, it's awesome when it works, and it really sucks when you got to debug it. And it's the latter that bites, real-world development of Terraform. So I've been wanting this for years and years and years because it would just simplify so much that we do when we use Kubernetes. I just am still pessimistic until I see it working, in production for organizations. All right. Next announcement. Yeah, something a little bit near and dear to my heart. So we get a lot of pull requests at Cloud Posse. Sometimes it feels like a DOS attack across all of our repos. And onboarding contributors is a challenge because there's lots of rules to follow. And businesses succeed or fail based on their processes. So I really like anytime we can kind of codify what that process looks like. We used Mergify a lot years ago. We stopped using it just because it got a little bit expensive. But there's been a lot of improvements to GitHub and Mergify that still make it more viable now for open source projects without having to have a large financial commitment on that. One of those things is like with repository rule sets. It's easy now to allow certain actors to override repository branch protections. So if you implement sufficient controls and checks within, for example, Mergify, and you allow Mergify to bypass certain repository protections, now it can work as a way to streamline your open source review workflow. So I spent a lot of time researching all the Mergify configurations out there. And I didn't come across anyone that was as robust or mature as what I've seen here. If you have examples, please share them my way. I think it's really interesting to get inspiration from other Mergify configurations. If you haven't looked at into Mergify, I should have led with this. Mergify is a software, it's a SaaS, free for open source, paid for private repositories, that lets you implement rule sets that act on pull requests. Those rule sets can look at like if that rule that PR is conflicted, or how when was the date of the last commit, when was the PR last touched, who made the changes, were those changes bots, what files were modified, what pairs of files were modified, like if this file's modified, you have to modify this other file, and probably 50 other conditions that you can check on a pull request. Now, you might be wondering, we can do a lot of that using GitHub Actions, status checks, and branch protections. One of the big problems that you have when you use GitHub Actions and status checks is that they're pretty binary. You can require Terraform tests to pass on your repository. What if I didn't change any Terraform files? Why should I run tests to make sure my Terraform tests pass when nothing changed? So Mergify is one of the ways you can solve that, because in Mergify, you can say, well, if Terraform files change, then require Terraform checks to pass. If the README is updated, like in Cloud Posse's case, then require the README to be updated, both files. And examples go on like that. So we went through here and defined first a whole bunch of YAML anchors so that we could label patterns. This makes it a lot easier for anyone working with the YAML to understand what's going on without always having to be an expert at perhaps Mergify. I think this is another case where why I really like YAML is because of YAML anchors. So here we've defined what does it mean to be a bot? What does it mean to not be a bot? Unfortunately, there's no negation of operators like and. What does it mean to be an external contributor? What does it mean to be the default branch? And it goes on and 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 on. And then finally, we get down to our conditions on pull requests here. And then here we implement all the rules now for the Cloud Posse open source organization to make it easier for contributors to find conflicted pull requests, to notify contributors that their pull requests are conflicted, to notify when somebody at Cloud Posse has to review this because sensitive files are touched. Keep in mind, a lot of this you get through the UI, it's just not always obvious to the different types of contributors you have in an organization. Also, what's really cool is a pro tip is you can use the new admonitions, the callouts that you support in Markdown. So you can make very pretty comments on pull requests. Dismissing reviews, that's an important one. When you work with a lot of different people who can review pull requests, the person who originally rejected that pull request might not be available to dismiss their own review. So let's just dismiss reviews automatically. Stale pull requests is a huge problem working with open source pull requests. People were very excited to get this feature in. Their priorities at work change. They're on to the next sprint. This is not their problem anymore. They disappear. We're left holding that pull request in perpetuity. We've gotten more strict about closing those when we don't get persistent feedback from the contributors. So yeah, any questions on this?
Does this modify the status checks on a branch protection, like when you have branch protection set up, or how does that integrate with the status
So
checks?
yeah, so there so status checks themselves are a different API. But are also supported by pull requests. So you can create as many new conditions as you want. So here's a condition. We haven't enabled this one yet. This is where we're building up to. We're just kind of maturing our confidence in this. So here we create a new status check that we're going to call mergeable. But mergeable is now a composite of all of these other things being true. So require Terraform checks are passing, but only when it's Terraform. Require that code owners are passing, but only when you modify the code owner's file. Require all checks are otherwise passing. Require approval. Require that the README was updated. Require that the PR has proper metadata, a good title, a good description, things like that. Now we are mergeable. I didn't mean to do that. All right. Oh, I don't know if you see what I see. I just saw a bunch of fireworks on my screen. All right. So that's that. And you can create as many of these as you want as well. So I'll be honest, one of the reasons why I didn't right away enable this is because I find this part here insufficient to convey why it's not mergeable. So here, status check is the status of all of this. If that is successful, then great, it'll say merged. Okay, we don't need to say more than that. But if any one of these fails, it's just going to say, hey, it's not ready to be merged. And then you got to be a sleuth to figure out why not. And I have to figure out a better, I feel like I'm doing maybe something wrong here. That makes it hard to communicate why it's not mergeable. So the solution might be to make this a composite of, say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 8 or 9 other checks. And then you'll see which one of those checks fail. And then this one requires those 7 or 8 checks to pass. But I haven't come there yet. Matt, looks like you have something.
I was just wondering, like in the else branch, can you actually just say like this PR is not ready to be merged because colon, and then like do a bunch of if statements, if not work in progress, then yeah, it's currently yeah, I don't work think in I progress. Can...
But this is just a YAML anchor that represents just, you know, some data structure. It's not an actual value. Yeah. So this not a work in progress just refers to one of these anchors that I had up here. So, you know, here's a is a work in progress. Here's not a work in progress, but it's just adding these conditions.
It's not right. So it's not evaluating the value of that. Yeah. Anchor at that point. I see.
Which is what I would love if there was a way. So.
Yeah. So maybe you need a status check. Is that what you just said? A status check for each one of those things, and then a composite that makes all of those successful before you can merge it. Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
That makes sense.
And I guess, you know, that's ultimately, I guess I wanted to reduce the number of checks that you see on the pull request, but ultimately that'll make it easier for anyone to look at it and see why it's failing.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, so that's that. We'll share the links afterwards. Next announcement is Stable Build just came across my radar. It's like a pull-through cache as a service. Supports a number of package types for your standard, Ubuntu, Debian, Alpine, Python packages, and Docker images. Obviously, you get pull-through cache capability with ECR, but only specific upstream public repositories. And my feedback here is like their pricing just doesn't make any sense if you're using it for Docker. 1 gigabyte file storage limit, hard limit as a pull-through cache. Let me see what images I can pull through and actually test this service out.
Well, that's on the free tier, right?
Yeah, but you want something where you can at least test that it works or validate or something. And well, yeah. A lot of images these days quickly will add up.
Yeah, I guess it depends what they have in their shared cache for layers.
Yeah.
Like across the board. So like if they have Ubuntu latest in their shared cache, like that won't count against your storage.
Oh, does it say that?
Pull through. No, I'm speculating. I'm just saying, like, I think it depends. It depends.
My guess is that's their margin right there. Yeah, you just added 15 kilobytes, but we're going to charge you for the full gig.
Yeah, I think the Docker use case is pretty bad on this. Like some of the other ones aren't too bad.
Yeah. Yeah, for regular like Debian packages, Python packages, this makes sense. For Docker, this doesn't work.
Yeah.
I found this because it was somehow linked to that other we talked about test containers mm-hmm. last week. I thought test containers was a cool open source project that provides containers for basically every major open source project out there for the purposes of using them with your integration tests. All right, last one here. I don't know whether to laugh or cry on this one, especially based on the title here. You know, I guess if you haven't been around the block for a while, you see this, oh, that's really cool. But if you have been around the block, we've just come through this era. Like there was OpenStack, there was the other one, CloudStack. Those projects are all but like on life support right now. I'm sure there's still massive enterprises indebted to them, but I mean, that's not the trajectory of things. So I don't think what we need right now is an open source alternative to AWS, but I, to be honest, haven't read the case here. That's just my preconceived notions. Anyone want to sell this one to me?
I don't know. Oh, good.
I'm about to suggest it to somebody to take a look at it because he wants to build a data center in Africa.
All right. I would probably look at still, you know, one of the proven new, you know, not a bleeding edge solution like this, but, you know, an OpenStack
or buy it from AWS. They sell everything.
Actually, that's not a bad idea because we do have that run AWS in your own data center and pay us money.
Yep. And I was just going to say, I like the one thing there that must be come with no caveats or anything else, that change one line in your workflow file, reduce costs by 10x. do you see that bullet point number one right there? Yes. that doesn't seem crazy at all.
Exactly. Now I realize that I have seen this, and that was really confusing to me because when I first saw it, I saw it more as some like GitHub runner alternative, like a managed runner service alternative. But now this is being pitched as a local, you know, locally managed cloud alternative. Aaron?
Yeah, isn't Kubernetes itself sort of a replacement for all the features of a cloud? I mean, you can run any sort of feature in a pod in Kubernetes, right? Isn't it sort of somewhat self-positioned to be the alternative to clouds, to cloud services anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily disagree. Obviously, a lot of Kubernetes relies on functionalities typically provided by the underlying cloud infrastructure itself. Companies do use Kubernetes in a bare metal scenario, but even then, it's often on VMware or some other system. So I don't know of too many examples where Kubernetes is used to replace an infrastructure as a service layer. But I think, yeah, fundamentally, I agree with you. It has all those concepts abstracted, storage, instances via pods, etc. Matt?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's a big swath of things that it doesn't provide for sure. But I think that it's a chicken and the egg thing. Like, how do you manage like all your bare metal and bootstrapping Kubernetes on all of that and adding, you know, security around it all and authentication and some of the things like that you would need, plus a portal, plus, you know, there's like a million things that seem to be missing from like building a true like platform as a service, if that's really what you're trying to do. This almost like, I expect to scroll to the bottom and see this signed by like DHH.
Right.
You know, with all the crazy stuff that's come out from that.
Yeah. Sounds like it could have been. Now it's probably the next wave. You know, these things are cyclical. The great bundling and unbundling. Now it's going to be like, First, there was no cloud, then we had cloud, and then there was OpenStack, then there was no OpenStack, we were back to cloud, then we had Kubernetes. Now we're back to bare metal and create your own cloud. And
Yeah,
we're learning all the way.
the only thing I will say is the team like that wrote this and is behind it has some legitimate like credibility from where they've been and what they've done, but I'm still a little skeptical on the whole thing.
Yeah. All right. Moving on. That was it. All right. Awesome. We get to Q&A. any last question announcements that I missed today? All right. Yeah, and Joakim mentions that Kubernetes still relies on something to provide like the storage layer and the network and load balancing layer and so forth. So you don't get that out of the box. So like, yeah, if you have everything software defined, Kubernetes is pretty good, but what's providing those software endpoints for you for Kubernetes to manage? All right. Next, Q&A. All right. All right, we addressed this one last week about Slack channels. And then we had the topic or conversation here on migrations and what are the best practices for doing that today. So let me start by reading the question. So what that's annoying. Hold on. All right, so to read the question here, what's the approach that most folks take these days for handling database migrations, for example, with Laravel or other frameworks? Do folks tightly couple the migrations with the application, applying them at the time of app code deployment? We still see this happen frequently, and it seems awful. So, Alex, this was your question asked a few weeks ago. Anything else you want to add to this? Also, since it's been a while, have you come to any conclusions since then? Did we miss you, Alex? I know you were on earlier.
Yeah, it looks like he dropped.
Ah, I'm glad I didn't promise it again. This is becoming like a running joke. Okay, well, I guess we gotta mix it up for next week
I
again.
can answer two things on this if it
All
helps.
right, go for it.
So one, if you have a DB migrate process, I never did Laravel, but I work with like say Flask and SQL Alchemy, or on their Ruby on Rails, there's a similar process. So you'd have an init container to handle the DB migrate. And then what I would suggest is having like your Kubernetes health checks and readiness checks. So if the thing's up, you could have a health check pass, but then for the readiness check, which communicates that the service proxy should send traffic to your set of applications, that wouldn't be available until after the DB migrate is finished. And so you could just have like something to kind of just query it's the database, make sure it's in the right version number and it's all up to date,
Yeah.
populate that table and then communicate the readiness check back. So you might need to do some instrumentalization to do that readiness check to say, hey, we're done with the DB migrate, or handle it in scripts around the init container.
Yeah,
That's
so
what
what
I'd
you
suggest.
describe is kind of like the one of the most common patterns popularized in Rails and running the migration as part of that deployment process. And I think it makes a lot more sense, keep it simple, stupid when you have a small number of pods, your typical, microservice for companies. Where it gets interesting is when you have, say, 1,000 pods running. Does it make sense that 1,000 pods all ran that init container, wait for a lock? Wait for, one wins the lock, the other ones are blocked. or depending on your strategy, just continue and then go for it. The other one is, so that handles the ideal case scenario where your work, and these are the only kinds of migrations you should typically be running, but are the migrations where adjacent releases are backwards compatible. Since when you do this for some portion of time, containers that are running already in the cluster are going to be accessing now perhaps migrated data while the new containers have yet to be fully rolled out and could be progressively rolling out. The other common pattern is decoupling schema migrations in, for example, database repository or as part of the monorepo. So those are rolled out separately. But now it's a coordination issue, and remembering or how you handle those coordinated releases becomes a separate topic to solve. So Matt, anything you
Yeah.
want to add?
Yeah, there's a couple other strategies too. I've worked in some extremely large organizations that have like tons and tons of developers potentially migrating schemas or making schemas changes. And there's two things there. One opportunity I've seen is basically just a policy where you never modify schema, you only add to schema. So if you need to change something, you create a new field or a new column like always and migrate the data as part of your schema, and then you can break the, like you were saying before, you can break the schema and deployment versus application deployment pattern into two different steps out there. So as long as you roll forward, copy the data to a new column using whatever functions you need to get the data into the new version that you expect it to be in, that's fine, and you never drop columns, which potentially can lead to some problems, but or you can only drop them after like a long period of time or something along those lines. That's one. Second, I've used some tools like Flyway and the like, to be able to do migrations as kind of a service. Like they have a really good tooling around doing migrations, doing the locking for you, making sure schemas are up to date, making sure that you get differences between schemas and can promote them among environments and all of those kinds of things. So that's one interesting thing. And then the last one I'll mention is if you look at some newer offerings like PlanetScale as an example, like PlanetScale's databases have some pretty interesting functionality in them, where they're actually doing the ability to you can like create a branch essentially
Oh,
for your database, test against your branch, and then you can merge it in, and then the schema changes like happen when you merge those things, and you can do it in CI, like just as you're deploying, you can basically merge the branches as well. Yeah, so it's basically like PlanetScale is doing the same thing. All of the kind of the prerequisite to being able to do all this though is that it's all like eventually consistent because like you can't because they spread the loads and things across multiple like geographically dispersed nodes, et cetera, but the technology is really cool if it works.
The branching thing,
And
though,
then,
yeah, absolutely.
yeah.
I'm really wishing Amazon either acquires or integrates something like this into their RDS offerings, because this seems
Yeah.
to be the trend right now of all the latest database tech.
And that's actually the middle column there is actually the most important point, is that it's non-blocking schema changes.
Yeah.
So like you can actually make the changes without any table locking, so you can continue to use your app, which is really cool, like how the whole thing works. So and it's almost instantaneous.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because those migrations can cause that locking, which causes a dogpiling, and
Yeah.
then suddenly your database is maxed out. All your clusters keep scaling up and then further compounding the problem. And It's always the database if it's not DNF.
I've seen it
it's
earlier.
Always I was just making a comment that it's always either your database or DNS that's the problem in NAP outage. So
I seen it early. I was at a company where I started the industry. They did ORM the wrong way, and then they had to change the databases because they're trying to kind of go microservices direction, but they had too many things coupled. So they were using either a queue or streaming solution, and then they'd start decoupling and they communicate to the queue to do what they needed and to get information back out of the queue. And that way they were able to segregate their database toward the services and decouple the services from the monolith.
Yeah, that sounds more like an event-based pattern, like with event sourcing. So you're taking like a list of all the events that happen in your stream, and then you can always replay that list of events to build different views of the data that you need at any time, like in the future. And the whole idea there is that it's like the CQRS like pattern. So the like commands which write things out, or commit data are different from queries, and they generally query different data sets and all that kind of thing. So you specialize, you create specialized views to align with the with the shape of the data that you're querying in any in any particular area of your application, but you build it all from events out there. So there's some specialized databases to do that as well, and a lot of people use like DynamoDB and SQS for that same pattern as well. So, but that you don't really have a defined schema at that point. You kind of have a lot of defined schemas that can be rebuilt from the event stream at any point. So that's a little bit of a different fit, I think, from traditional database migrations.
There's also an interesting tool I posted. I've never used it in my life, and it's called Atlas, which it's
all right.
A little bit confusing because we have MongoDB and its enterprise Atlas offering, which is not related to SQL migrations. But basically, this Atlas, I posted like the link to the Kubernetes operator, and this Atlas tool is interesting because it actually uses HCL as its DSL, or at least has an option for that. I've never used it, full disclosure, but what it's interesting is that you could potentially use the operator, and I think it's appropriate if you have this as a Kubernetes resource and deploying it with Argo CD, it might end up rolling back nicely. Atlas itself also advertises on its landing page that because it's HCL, you could integrate with Terraform, which I think is a terrible, terrible idea. But I guess they do advertise it like that because of the shared DSL. But yeah, I think it's a terrible idea to link all your business logic and applications and low-level things like infrastructure with your VPCs and all of that. But you can do that if you want to, I guess, with this project.
To be clear, they borrowed on the HCL language without it being Terraform HCL, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but if you scroll down.
And then later on, they added a provider, I think.
Like this, if you scroll down a little bit more, a little bit more. Yeah, that's what scares me when it's like you pass it, but just like the database migrations of Terraform. Yeah, I don't want to be working in a place that does that. That just sounds scary, but could do that.
The funny thing, like I often describe Terraform itself as a database migration tool, but for infrastructure, except for it's like doing migrations outside of transactions, and it's up to you to figure out how to do the rollback. So imagine, coupling that, unpredictable behavior with doing
in there.
Migrations as well.
Yeah, I mean, technically, Terraform's a state machine, right? I mean, that's what it is at its core. It's basically saying, here's my desired state. It will read the it reads the current state from the cloud provider and then tries to reconcile and get current state to equal desired state by you know using providers to do that. And unfortunately, state machines don't generally have a like a recording of all the interim steps like that it took along the way to do that. And then that's why they can't roll back. They can only go from current state to desired state. And you know, sometimes that doesn't work that well for all the tools. So it'd be interesting if someone had a transaction-based IAC tool.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of what that is, but not the IAC level. Like the operator, I think, implies that if you set up these so the CRD exposed by the Atlas operator, supposedly if you make the resource for migration, that would mean that you can later delete it and it would undo the migration. That's what it seems like to me, but I haven't read into it. And I think actually that would be really nice to have developers, you have a Helm chart and you actually have developers writing out these migrations as code in the Atlas operator resource. I think that would be a nicer pattern than have them hiding away those migrations deeply inside some scripts that may not roll back nicely or may not be backwards compatible if you're deploying with Argo CD and then later you need to roll back. Might be a decent project to look into.
And now they have a cloud platform as well. Does it require working with Atlas Cloud, or is it also just a pure open source component to it?
I think it's pure open source, and I guess it's compatible with MySQL and Postgres. I have no idea.
It says that it works with Flyway too, so that's an interesting piece. So I don't quite understand that. So it's just like an orchestration engine, maybe, and a few other things. Like that's an interesting one, a schema registry.
Yeah, that is interesting. Also, drift detection for schema for databases. It seems obvious in hindsight, but I don't think a lot practice that.
Is it just copying tacos and Terraform? It did the ACL thing. And now it's like schema register, model register. Okay, schema
databases registry. As infrastructure. Oh, and drift, apply the
drift detection. Now we have drift detection as well.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, those concepts existed in databases way before they existed in IAC tools. So if anything, it's the other way around.
Maybe Terraform copied those tools.
Under the hood, it's a graph database.
There was some ambitious project to infrastructure.